And I'll be introducing the speaker today. And I'm very pleased to give you the opportunity to hear Mike Wiedmer talk about mega floods in Alaska. This is some really important work, and I'm sure some of you have heard of the Brett's floods in the Columbia River system. These floods that you'll be hearing about in Alaska have never been described. So, and this is maybe one of the, first few public unveiling of these new exciting results. I'll tell you a little bit about Mike. He's got a very interesting history. Currently, he's a doctoral student in the School of Forest Resources and also an ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. But before that, he for about 20-plus years, he was a habitat biologist for Alaska Fish and Game. And a lot of the observations you'll be hearing about today are the result of those 20 or more years in Alaska observing the natural environment. Mike Wiedmer got his bachelor's degree at Reed in biology, and then he's explored a lot of different fields, geology, biology, fisheries ecology, and those sorts of things. So without any further ado, I will introduce Mike. And
Earth's largest freshwater floods were a result of catastrophic draining of massive glacially dammed ice age lakes. These floods sculpted regional landscapes, altered oceans and climates. And this is a current list of quaternary mega floods. My colleagues and I are proposed to add several newly discovered Alaskan deluges. So today we're going to review the geomorphic, stratigraphic, geotechnical, and biogeographic evidence that supports these outrageous claims. All right, how did I get started on this? Christian gave you a little bit of background on what I did in a previous life. And the first slide there on the left is the Meadow Lakes area near Wasilla, Alaska. And I grew up not too far away from this area. And I was always intrigued by these oriented lakes and tried to figure out what caused their particular alignment. And on the right is an insignificant, overlooked, maligned fish that as a fully mature adult never gets bigger than the palm of your hand. But it was the discovery of this fish in an unexpected location that, in the combination with the Meadow Lakes, that led me on this path, which has kept me busy for the last couple of years. All right, let's parse the title of the talk. What do we mean by Lake Quaternary? Well, the Quaternary is a period started about 2.6 million years ago. We're still in it today. And it's mostly the Pleistocene, but the epoch that we're in right now is the Holocene. That started roughly 12,000 years ago. So the period that we're going to be talking about is the very end of the Pleistocene and the very beginning of the Holocene. In North America, the last ice age that we had here was called the Wisconsin or the Wisconsinan. A lot of geologists now refer to marine isotope stages. So the marine isotope stage we're talking about is MIS-2. So it's the very last glacial period and roughly peaking around 20,000 years ago. So that gives you a general time frame about when we're talking. All right, mega floods. What caused the largest mega floods? Well, in general, it was large ice sheets advancing often through somewhat mountainous terrain. They would block river courses. And when they did that, they would impound really large lakes. Those glacial dams, though, are inherently unstable, and occasionally they would fail. And when they failed, those really large lakes suddenly drained in various directions. And the height of the dam makes a big difference on how big a flood you would end up with. And these things happen mostly in the northern hemisphere because it had that combination of really large ice sheets and the mountainous terrains necessary to create these floods. Later on, we'll be making a distinction between two dam failure modes. The first is an Icelandic term from the Icelandic words for glacier and flood. Jökulhlaup is as close as I'm going to get today to pronouncing that, but it's in the way we're using it today, and it's been used in a lot of different ways, but the way we're going to use it today is a rather gradual enlargement of ice tunnels within the glacier, such that the glacier isn't completely destroyed, but the water drains out through tunnels within the glacier. The other mode of failure is when the dam just completely breaks down and just has a gaping breach in it, and all of the impounded water then races through that breach. The Jökulhlaups can be initiated in several ways. As I said, it's an Icelandic term, and of course in Iceland you have a lot of volcanic activity in addition to the glaciers. So if you have a volcano under a glacier, you often get a heating of the ice and erosion of ice tunnels, and you get releases through the volcanic heating of the capping ice sheet. Ice being buoyant can also be floated. If you have a water depth that's roughly 90% the height of the ice dam, the ice dam starts to float, and then the water can go out underneath the ice. It can pipe out through tunnels within the ice, or the ice, particularly during the end of the ice ages, the end of the glacial advances, the ice starts to waste and degrade, and that can lead to ice dam failure. All right. Megafloods, there is actually a definition for megafloods. A megaflood has to have a peak discharge of over 1 million cubic meters per second. And that's a lot. It's challenging to say 1 million cubic meters per second a lot in a presentation, so we use the term Sverdrup, or SV, and that term is actually an oceanographic term in honor of Harald Sverdrup, and it was originally used to talk about things like the Gulf Stream, you know, massive currents in the ocean that move at just a tremendous quantity of water, but it was found that it was appropriate for the very largest freshwater floods as well. So for comparison, the Amazon River, the highest recorded flood ever in the Amazon, peaked out at about 0.37 Sverdrups. The modern Columbia, the biggest flood in 1800s, peaked out at one order of magnitude less than that, at about 0.035 Sverdrups. So you can see that one Sverdrup is really big. It's roughly three times larger than the biggest flood ever on the biggest modern river on the planet. So what are the very biggest quaternary megafloods? Well, as you can see, they're mostly, they're all in the northern hemisphere. And if we start from your left, we've got the several near the border of Mongolia and Russia. The Yenisei, the Kuray, and the Ulagan all have peak floods above one Sverdrup. And the Tsangpao down in the Himalayas recently was estimated to have a flood of five Sverdrups. Over in North America, we've got Lake Agassiz, which although is just a huge, unbelievably large lake, because it's relatively low relief on the landscape, its peak floods were around seven Sverdrups, but the total volume that was released was just astronomical. Missoula, which is nearest and dearest to people here in Washington, it affected the state of Washington more than any other state, is the monster flood at 17 Sverdrups. Aniakchak is actually not a glacial dam failure, but it was a caldera, a volcanic caldera that filled with water and then catastrophically drained not all that long ago, several thousand years ago. And Pluvial Lake Bonneville, where Salt Lake is now, the Great Salt Lake, it filled up and then just overtopped the mountain pass and then kind of gradually eroded down. If you had been there, you wouldn't have thought it was gradual, but it was not as catastrophic as the Missoula floods. I should mention that particularly for Missoula and Agassiz and some of the others, that these numbers here are just the peak floods, but they're thought to have flooded many times. Missoula, for example, is estimated to have flooded maybe 100 times. and several of those being very large floods. So I'm only listing here the very biggest ones. So these mega floods that I've talked about, they carved regional landscapes, and they structured the current use of the land of humans. So here we are in the Channel Scablands of eastern Washington. You can see the track of the flood there, the the lighter tan streaks that go from the top left, or top right, excuse me, to the bottom left. Those are the flood routes. And it's not all that clear from this picture, but it actually structures the farming in this area. Long ago, the wheat farmers and the Palouse decided they were going to farm the hilltops, and the wheat farmers are very good at determining the peak elevation of the flood, because that's the lower limit at which they farm. Because what they're farming, what they're planting their wheat seed in, is the loess that was deposited before these floods, and then the floods came down and scoured all out that loess, so they can't farm where the flood went through. And in addition to just changing the way the farmers farmed the land, it also created some very dynamic, very charismatic features on the landscape. As I mentioned, Lake Agassiz had just a huge volume of water impounded in it, and it drained out as the glaciers, the Laurentide ice sheet retreated. It drained very many different directions. And it's thought that when these huge volumes of water hit the ocean and formed a freshwater lens floating on the surface of the ocean, it interrupted, like the Gulf Stream, which is a very big in structuring the climate of northern Europe. So it is these floods have been synchronized to the initiation of several major climate changes, like the Younger Dryas, Preboreal Oscillation, and the 8.2 Ka cold event. All right, so this list of freshwater floods, we're going to add several new ones in South Central Alaska. So here's South Central Alaska. South Central Alaska is kind of defined by that area which is south of the Alaska Range, which is a crest of mountains that goes over the top of the screen there. The Alaska and particularly a particular feature in the in South Central Alaska is the Copper River Basin, which is bounded by the Alaska Range to the north, the Talkeetna Mountains to the west, the Wrangell Mountains to the east, and the Chugach Mountains to the south. Also, draw your attention to the Susitna River over there to the left, and Cook Inlet, and then the city of Anchorage, what we'll talk about later, is marked there in the center left of the screen. The Copper River Basin today is drained by the Copper River, which, of course, is the source of all the excitement in mid-May when all the Copper River sockeye salmon show up in the Pike's Place Market. Well, 20,000 years ago, South Central Alaska didn't look the way it does now. This is the late glacial maximum for South Central Alaska. And obviously you can see the terrain was a lot different. Most of the South Central was occupied by great thicknesses of glacial ice. In particular, Copper River Basin was sealed off by major glaciers moving in from all the mountain ranges that I just described. And glaciers descended down the Susitna, down into Cook Inlet and filled Cook Inlet. All right, the first geologist that visited the Copper River Basin was Schrader in the Abercrombie expedition just a little over 100 years ago. The squares in the center there are the areas that he explored. So as a result of his 1898 exploration, he gave this report. This is Schrader, by the way, on the left, in his field git. And he said, based on his field trip there that summer of 1898, that he thinks that there was a large lake or branch of the sea that seems to have been deposited in the Pleistocene. Unfortunately, he went back the following year and wrote another report and changed his mind. This is a good example of sticking with your first hunch. He was right the first time and wrong the second time, but we won't blame him too much. So he's the discoverer of what later became known as Lake Otten. There are many places in the Copper River Basin where you can see really deep exposures of glacial sediments, both glacial and glacial lake sediments. And from these exposures, Nichols back in 1965 reported that he saw evidence of at least five Pleistocene glacial advances. There's almost certainly more, but that's as far down into the rock record or the stratigraphic record he could see. Each of those five advances created a lake. And the last lake that was created, he called that Glacial Lake Otna. Otna, by the way, is a local native group. Latest Lake Otna appears to have had a fairly long lifespan. It was created more than 58,000 years ago in radiocarbon years, and it moved up and down in elevation and in extent before it finally drained roughly 10,000 years ago. Now we're going to shift our view to the Matanuska Valley, which exits the southwest corner of the Copper River Basin. And here is a close-up view of the Matanuska Valley. And we're going to look at some flood evidence that we think exists along the course of this 100-kilometer valley that ends up at the town of Wasilla, just north of Anchorage. In the lower right corner, you see a blow-up of the square that's at the top there. And back in 1986, this was mapped by a couple of geologists who identified a flow path. And the way they drew it, it was about up to 975 meters, which they didn't say it, but happens to coincide with the highest documented lake elevation, Lake Otna elevation. And they also drew the bounds of a spillway, which is the dashed line there. And that dashed line just happens to be 914 meters high, which coincides with the highest kind of stable lake level that's been documented in Lake Otna. So Williams and Galloway mapped these features, but they didn't interpret them. They didn't say where the water came from, and they didn't say where the water went. Down at the end, the bottom end, it'll be a little important to know this. There is a feature called the Elmendorf Moraine. It's a bilobate terminal moraine. The northern lobe was formed by the Matanuska Glacier coming down the Matanuska Valley, and the southern lobe was formed by the Knik Glacier, which is just there at the edge of the box above that black lake there. And so we think that the Elmendorf Moraine was occupied, oh, let's say 15, 16,000 years ago, maybe a little more, 17,000 years ago. All right, we're going up to Tanita Pass now. This is the pass between the Copper River Basin and the Matanuska River. And in that, in the inlet to the Matanuska Valley, we see a series of longitudinal parallel, roughly parallel grooves oriented to the mouth of the valley. And we also see grooves like this in other... I've got it here. But in the left one over there, you see these grooves. It's maybe not all that clear. But on the image on the right, which is Grand Coulee in the Missoula flood, the Channel Scablands here in Washington, you also see longitudinal grooves leading right up to a fairly significant gradient drop. Just down valley, still sitting in the pass, Tanita Pass, is this island here. The top of the island is above what I call it an island. It just sticks up, juts up above the surrounding landscape. The top of this island, we think, is above the highest water level, but that inflection, that slope inflection that you see on the left, is what we think is the highest lake level, and the flat ground at the base of the island is the highest stable lake level of Lake Otna. If you look in a plan view of the of this island, it has a it's streamlined, and the streamlining is consistent with islands that you also see within the Channel Scablands and even in the Columbia River and the Mississippi River and other places like that. In the middle of the Matanuska Valley, where the orange line is pointing, we should see a lot of till. The till is the material left behind by glaciers, but it's not there. It's certainly not there in any large amount. So the question is, how come there's not any till? Well, we think it might have been swept away by a flood, or it would have the flood would have really disrupted the glacier that was sitting there, and thus eliminating the source of the till. Here's another one of these streamlined islands. Again, it has a length-width ratio of 3.2, and the widest part of the island is also where fluvial dynamics predicts it should be in a water environment, in a flowing water environment. These forms can also be caused by glaciers, but when they are, particularly in a narrow confined valley like this, we would expect them to be much longer and having a length-width ratio of more like 10. This view is from an adjacent valley that was glaciated. All right, so moving down valley, we're now down in kind of the flatlands, back to the picture I told you that was one of my inspirations. Here is the topo map for the Beaver Lakes and Meadow Lakes. And if we look at this in a hillshade generated from a DEM, the features start to get much more striking. And we can do, since we have it in a DEM, we can start to model the terrain, look at the regularity of the spacings of these ridges. We can look at how high the ridges are. And so we've got roughly 25 ridges that run crossways across the valley. They have heights up to 34 meters. They're real regularly, almost a kilometer from crest to crest. And we'll get into the details about, so the Stoss angle is the leading edge, the upslope of the ridge, and the lee is the downslope of the ridge. Unfortunately, because there's such big features, there's not very many places where you can see what these ridges are made of. But there is one. It's behind the Gorilla Fireworks Stand. And behind the Gorilla Fireworks Stand, there is a junkyard. And behind the junkyard, there is a small gravel mining operation. And that guy has been very kind to have exposed the interior of one of these ridges for us. So this is what it looks like. It's made out of fluvial material. It's all well-rounded gravels, cobbles, occasional boulders. These fluvial-deposited gravels have quite steep foresets, which for our purposes just means that the water was flowing pretty rapidly when they were deposited. Now, people have looked at these ridges before, not with the hillshade, not with the tools that we have now, but just tromping around the ground, and they said, well, how did these come to be? And one of the first explanations was that it was a folded medial moraine from the Matanuska Glacier. But this doesn't seem to be consistent with the evidence that we have in hand now. Another more recent interpretation is still 20-some-odd years old, this interpretation, almost 30, was that it was a Rugen moraine. And they were called Rugen moraines because a paper had just come out on Rugen moraines, and so the geologist said, well, let's call them that. But what we think they are water-form dunes, because they look so much like dunes found in other megaflood sites. Dunes are such a key feature, it's become like the primary diagnostic for megafloods, is the feature of dune trains. Superimposed on these large ridges that you can see are many hundreds of much smaller dunes that sit on top. The picture on the bottom there is a cross-section of one of them. And these were interpreted as De Geer moraines. Now, De Geer moraines are recessional moraines from as glaciers recede during the end of the ice ages, they leave behind this evidence. But this is bad news because we think that the flood which created the big dunes happened after the glacier retreated. So if we have these ice glacier retreat forms sitting on top of the dunes, that kind of blows a hole in our theory. So this has caused us a lot of anxiety. Well, we've got, again, some new tools. We've got quick bird satellite imagery, and fortunately for us, unfortunately for the people in the area, there was the 1996 Miller's Reach fire, which just took out a large amount of the forest canopy, so we can see the area within that polygon much better. And when we map the distribution of these degree of moraines, we notice a couple of things. We notice, one, that they seem to be restricted only to the area, the footprint, where the large dunes are located. And we see that they're oriented in the same way that the dune upon which they sit is oriented. We think that indicates that they have a common genesis. We also can find from the literature examples of what they call two orders of bed forms, one sitting on top of the other. And where this occurs, it's thought to be the result of a real rapidly declining flood stage. So we have a big flood, and then it kind of shuts off. And when it shuts off, it's able to preserve both orders of those bed forms. And fortunately for us, the relationship in size between what are called the Greer moraines and these larger dunes in Wasilla have the same ratio as what's been reported in other areas. Scientists always like to name things, so we have a method of coming up with a name for these features. So because of its spacing and height, these are very large dunes, because they tend to be very symmetrical as you go along their crest. They're symmetrical dunes. Subaqueous, they're two-dimensional, and because you have two orders, one small dune sitting on top of the other, they're compounds, so that comes up with that whole 2D symmetrical, very large compound, subaqueous dune. We call them VLDs. I won't belabor this picture, but people have done a lot of empirical observation on relationships between the slopes of dunes and how high they are, how high the dunes are and how far apart they are, and fortunately for us, the dunes in Wasilla seem to fit these relationships, so it's another support for considering them water-formed dunes. All right, what other kind of supporting evidence do we have? Well, Anchorage, where Anchorage sits now, as the glaciers retreated, of course, there was this massive weight of ice sitting on the lowlands around Anchorage, and that massive weight of ice depressed the land surface so much that the marine waters rose quite a bit higher than they currently are. And that marine environment deposited sediments where Anchorage sits now. And those marine sediments are collectively called the Bootlegger Cove Formation. And there are seven different elements within the Bootlegger Cove Formation. And they just represent different fluctuations in the depositional environment. The 1964 earthquake, the damage in Anchorage, was a result of the failure of one of these individual strata within the Bootlegger Cove Formation. And if we, when the geophysicist looks specifically at that narrow layer that was the result of the land failure, which is a narrow layer, I mean, we're talking about less than a meter out of 60 meters of marine sediments. There was one less than a meter thick area that was particularly sensitive. And when you look at that one layer, you see that the structure of the materials, although the materials themselves are the same as in the other parts of the Bootlegger Cove Formation, the way they're oriented to each other, the individual materials, the individual sediments, are oriented in a very unusual way. And in the pore spaces between those card house clay and silt particles, we have fresh water, which you wouldn't expect in a marine deposited sediment. And additionally, the fresh water in those pore spaces didn't get there as a result of later leaching, which sometimes occurs. So we think this is a fingerprint of the flood entering the waters of Kinnick Arm and Upper Cook Inlet. All right, I promised some people pictures of fish. Here is the pygmy whitefish. It has a northern distribution. Its distribution is almost entirely restricted to the footprint of the Laurentide and Cordilleran ice sheets. And it was widespread during the last ice age, but is very restricted, very disjunct in its distribution now. Back in the 70s, Bird and Roberson reported finding pygmy whitefish in three lakes that are the remnants of Glacial Lake Otna. And in 2005, I found them in Lake George, which is that orange arrow over in the bottom left corner. This is the only known habitat for them in all of the Cook Inlet Basin. This is a Lake George here. It's a proglacial lake. It's probably a good analog for what the lakes looked like during the last ice age. We had enough literature information, and we had samples that we had collected in Lake George to make some comparisons based on meristics. Meristics are things that you can count on fish in this particular case, and here are the things that we counted, and we were able to compare them to other literature values. There were 32 other populations worldwide that we were able to compare them to, and we did a principal components analysis of for each of those 32 populations. They segregated into these three groupings, which fortunately for us reflected well geographic distribution. And what it basically says is that the Lake George fish in the Cook Inlet are more closely related to the Copper River Basin fish than they are to others. We also put boots on the ground in the Mat Valley, the Matanuska Valley. We've got some 300 sites that we've visited to look at the surficial geology. You know, what kind of material is it? Was it deposited fluvial? Was it deposited glacially? We can also distinguish rock types that come from the Matanuska from rock types that come from the Kinnick Glacier. And the result of this supports our original geomorphic conclusion that a flood came down to Matanuska while a glacier remained extended out into Kinnick Arm, the Kinnick Glacier extended out into Kinnick Arm. So here's our reconstruction of the flood. Maybe I should get the pointer out here. All right, let's see. Let's start up here. We've got four sets. Four sets, again, are these steeply dipping fluvial beds. And we've got them here hundreds of meters above the Matanuska River. And they're angled this way, indicating a flow this way. Certainly the modern river would never have deposited material up there in that form. We've got this elevation here. This dark red, as you can see down here, is relatively high ground. This high ground up here, which we know is mostly fluvial material, we think is just a huge, ginormous river mouth bar. And that has not been previously interpreted as such, but we think that the evidence suggests that that's exactly what it is. And over on this side, we see a bit of a trench on between the bar and the slopes of the Talkeetna Mountains. This foss or moat is also a feature of the bars in the Missoula Scablands. Most of the bars there have also this depression between the bar and the adjacent mountainside. These arrows reflect where we think the flow went. This arrow here, we think, reflects the general location of the Kinnick Glacier. So the Kinnick Glacier came down here and extended out here and was about here at the time of the flood. This feature here represents the readvance after the flood of the Kinnick Glacier. So all this landscape here came after the flood. And over here is where the sensitive Bootlegger Cove facies is, and this is where all the major landslides in Anchorage occurred during 1964.
So at this time you're saying, well, Mike, this is all well and good, but there are things that you haven't told us that we really want to know. And I'm here to help. Fox's latest commentator is House, is that icon there. All right, moving on. We can calculate how high we can calculate the discharge volumes and the fluxes, or at least we can put estimates, upper and lower estimates on it. What we need to know is how high the dam was, how high the water was above the pass, essentially. We need to know the volume of water that was backed up behind that, and we need to know the dam failure moat. With those pieces of information, we can start to make estimates on discharges. So the bounding that we had to do was that we know the lake wasn't as big as shown up here because this has no ice moving into the basin. The ice had to move into the basin in order to block the outlets, the Copper River, for example, and the Susitna. So we know this is unrealistically big. And we think this is probably unrealistically small, but this is the maximum ice advance during the late Wisconsin. So those are the two bounding conditions that we put on our calculations of lake volume. We can also estimate how long a flood occurred if we know the discharge if we know the discharge, then we know how long it takes to drain the lake. So the results of our calculations, won't belabor all those numbers down at the bottom, but we know what the surface elevation of the lake was, how much area it covered, you know, what the volume was, the dam height, how much volume was able to decant through each of the passes, what the discharge was, and how long it would take to drain the lake at those different stages. So here is we had a map of the largest floods previously recorded. And this is our new interpretation of where our new floods are. So we're capping out at Susitna, we think might be equivalent to Kurei in Asia. The Matanuska, we think, is somewhere around 2.5 sferodrupts. And the Tok River, which I haven't talked much about, which is a drainage this way into the Yukon drainage, is potentially up around 1 sferodrupt, so just big enough to get onto the mega flood list. So we think that Lake Otna decanted in a sequence of drainages like a pinwheel, first down the Matanuska, then down the Susitna, then down the Tok River into the Tanana Yukon drainage, and lastly down the Copper River into the Gulf of Alaska. And also, the lake lasted a really long time. And coupled with some of the fish observations we've made, we think that this has implications for glacial Lake Otna being a really important but overlooked glacial refugia for freshwater forms. We can also calculate flow depths by Sarah Palin's house. Here is one method for these calculations based on the heights of the dunes. The dunes decrease in size in a linear order, and based on those heights, we can calculate the elevation of the water, and we think it's up around 130 meters or so at the upper end of those dunes. All right, so let's wrap up. We think that Lake Otna levels were 60 meters plus above the pass elevation, so certainly sufficiently high to drain out through the Matanuska Valley. We've got previously mapped flow lines that indicate that other people have thought that water moved from the Copper River Basin into the Matanuska Valley. Where we would expect to see till, we don't find any. Where we expect to see recessional moraines in the Matanuska Valley, we don't find any. We see fluvial streamlined islands that correspond to both mathematical and empirical evidence of what islands in rapidly flowing water should look like. And particularly at the bottom of the valley there, we've got these very large dunes, which is very difficult to associate with any other kind of formation. They got very high. We've got this thin layer in the Bootlegger Cove formation that is very sensitive, has very odd structure that suggests that it was formed in a turbulent freshwater environment. We've got Lake George at the adjacent to the flood path that supports pygmy whitefish that don't occur anywhere else except in the Copper River Basin. So we conclude that a really large amount of water decanted down Tanita Pass, through Tanita Pass, down to Matanuska Valley, at a rate of up to 3.3 sphaerodrupts. You know, later discharge down the Susitna River may have been much bigger yet, making Glacial Lake Otten a serial generator of some of the Earth's biggest floods. And with that, we'll take some questions. Although not everyone at once, please. This is overwhelming. All right, I got a question. Well, we think that big floods, the Susitna and Tanita Pass floods, based on other evidence, we think these were catastrophic dam failures. So at least the Matanuska flood, we're pretty sure was catastrophic failure. Let's say it was 2.5 sphaerodrupts. We're talking about a week to drain what? 1,000 cubic kilometers of water? It's a lot of water. You would have wanted to have a very high vantage point.
I've got one. How did the pygmy whitefish survive that flood?
Well, the thing is that there was the flood, but then Lake Otna just drained in a normal fashion down the Matanuska Valley for probably quite a bit of time after that until the Susitna failed, and then that lowered the lake level below Tanita Pass. But there's clear evidence that there was a fairly normal but large river that flowed through there from the Copper River Basin down to the Matanuska.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am. Well, it kind of depends on where you were in the Missoula flood route. Certain in the upper part, it also happened very quickly. But lower down in the flood path, particularly when it got into the Columbia River, the Wallula Gap, and downstream from there, there were several areas where the flood got really confined, and that backed up the water. So in the upper part of the drainage, the flood probably also was on the order of a week or so, days to a week. But down in the lower part of the river, it was more like a month, roughly, for all the water that was backed up behind these confining restrictions in the Columbia River to work their way through.
Well, thank you very much, Mike.